Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, April 1st, April Fool's Day, 2014. I have a little placeholder that says do a joke, but I'll move on. So we're bringing the meeting in order. We have Senator Ellis, Senator Michicki, and myself, Senator Dunleavy, so we do have a quorum. Please turn off your phones. We've got three bills we're going to hear today, two House bills and one Senate bill. This will be the introduction of all three bills. We'll hear them and provide time for public to comment on them. So the bills today would be SB 214, Insurance Adjuster Licensing, HB 204, Salmon and Herring Product Development Tax Credit, and HB 141, Workers' Compensation Medical Fees. So we turn first to SB 214. It's a bill sponsored by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. This is the first hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill would be my staff member, Steve Ritchie. And we're going to ask him to identify himself for the record and begin his testimony. So please begin, Steve.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Ricci. I'm staff to Senator Dunleavy and the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. What you have before you here, last year, Senate Bill 58, which was passed by the committee, established the regulatory framework for portable electronics insurance in the state. What Senate Bill 214 does is follow up on the guidelines for adjusting the claims made on those portable electronic devices. In practicality, someone that is making a portable electronics claim either has a broken device or not. So the person assisting consumers with replacement are truly performing a clerical function and not involved in valuation of damages. Devices are either replaced or they're not. It's pretty clear. The language beginning on page 3, line 30, which continues on page 4, outlines the ability of one registered adjuster in the state to oversee up to 25 individuals helping process paperwork and furnish people new phone or new electronic devices, and the bulk of it is cell phones. That's really the heart of the bill. There is some language that we're working on currently, which is further necessary, which deals with home state, and we will be bringing that forth at another time in a CS. I just wanted to make members of the committee aware that there is additional language that is necessary for this bill.
Okay, and Steve, are there folks here with the industry and with the state as well?
Yes, Paul Fassenbender is here, and he is with Assurian, which is a company that is involved with portable electronics insurance. There's also Marty Hester from the Division of Insurance, and I believe Stephen McDaniel is retained counsel for Assurian.
Okay. Is Mr. Fassbender here?
Yes, sir.
Could you come forward, please, and sit next to Steve here? State your name for the record, and that way if we have questions, you might want to stay there, Steve, because we may have questions for you as well. Please state your name for the record and give any testimony that you're prepared to give, and we'll then begin to ask some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Fassbender. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Economic Development with a company called Assurian, based in Nashville, Tennessee. We are the world's largest insurance provider for portable electronic insurance. Most of our products we provide insurance are on phones. As Steve said, this is a dovetail on a bill last year that you all were nice enough or kind enough to pass and that we got through here, which establishes standards for the adjusting of these claims. Right now, yeah, we can adjust these claims. We have passed this legislation in 23 states. What this will do is add further certainty on adjusting the claims of portable electronics so there are no gray areas. This will give stability to the market and to our clients as well as us in operating in a regulated environment.
Thank you. And we'll add one more person for questions here. Mr. McDaniel, are you online? Mr. McDaniel? Stephen McDaniel.
He said he was on.
I am here. Yes, Chairman.
Could you please identify yourself for the record and who you're associated with?
Sure. My name is Stephen McDaniel. I work with a law firm, Mead & PA, in Tallahassee, Florida. We are outside regulatory counsel for Assurian, here to answer any technical questions that may come up.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee at this point? Seeing none, we're going to open this up for public testimony. Do we have anyone online that wishes to, other than folks that are prepared for questions, anyone else online? Seeing none. Anyone else in the audience? Seeing none, we are going to leave the public testimony open. Any questions before we keep moving through the agenda? Senator Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, through you to Steve, I was unsure from your comments, what is the subject of the new language that you're working on for the committee and a CS? What's the subject of the language?
Sure. Senator Ellis, through the chair. There's some issues with home state, and it's somewhat technical, where adjusters are registered and what their home state is and whether or not there's a physical presence in the state. Marty Hester may be able to better describe the precise issues. We are working with the department on crafting language to address this issue. It's really not a substantive change. It's a technical change that the Division of Insurance noticed.
And who brought it to your attention, the industry or our insurance folks, or how did it come up?
The industry, as well as working, and we've been working with the Division of Insurance.
Senator Ellis, through the chair, this issue, it is a consequence of a virtual marketplace that we have now. We have insurance adjusters or adjusters that supervise the clerical folks who take these claims all over the United States, and they apply for non-resident adjuster license in various states. It's a technical issue dealing with where they can claim their home state is, and if they have to have a brick-and-mortar facility in that state, or if they have to be a resident of that state. When a lot of these insurance laws were drafted, and some of these they did not take into account maybe a business model like ours. We have a very heavy, I can speak for Assurion, our claim volume last year was 11 million claims. Having people being able to telecommute like that assists our business, and this would be simply evolving a non-resident license holder and what they're allowed to claim as their home state.
We can bring up Mr. Hester as well. Mr. Hester, could you come forward, please?
You want me to?
Sure.
Okay.
You could state your name for the record and who you're with, and then we can maybe you can shed further light on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Marty Hester, Deputy Director, Division of Insurance.
The question was over the language change that's coming out at CS, and what was the reason for that, and where did it come from?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, as Paul, and I'm not sure if his last name, just mentioned, the brick and mortar, Paul Fassenbinder, the brick and mortar position that non-resident adjusters have had to apply under, if your state requires or does not require a license for this particular type of insurance, then they don't have to have that brick and mortar type of place or a storefront so that someone could come to. If they were required to have that residency or the state that they were home stated in required them to have such a type of operation, which Alaska does, then they would have to have a storefront for someone to come to. A company that's doing mostly virtual, and it's not just Assuring, but it would be any company that's doing virtual claims these days. This would allow the possible change that's coming forward would allow them to operate from the state that they're currently licensed out of.
Any additional questions for these folks? Seeing none, public testimony is open on this bill. We'll set the bill aside, and we will hear it again at a near future date. So with that, we're going to just take a brief at ease to move to the next bill. Back in session. We're now moving to House Bill 204. It's a bill sponsored by Representative Osterman. This is the first hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill would be Ashtree Rose, staff to Representative Osterman. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, that would be great.
Sure, thank you. For the record, my name is Ashtree Rose, staff to Rep. Osterman. Rep. Osterman sends his regrets for not being able to be here to present the bill in person. House Bill 204 extends the fisheries tax credit statute, which allows seafood processors to receive a 50% tax credit, 50% credit for designated equipment that is used for the in-state production of value-added salmon products. The original intent of the program was to create additional value from salmon through new products, which would move salmon out of the tall cans and into more innovative products. During the salmon crisis about a decade ago, the market was awash with pinks, chums, and sockeyes packed with skin and bones into one-pound cans. Consequently, the price for salmon, especially pinks and chums, was extremely low for both fishermen and processors. For the salmon that is still going into cans, a good market has developed for small, skinless, boneless salmon cans to compete with canned tuna in a similar can size portions. The tax credit has helped facilitate a partial conversion of can lines to create this new method of selling salmon. Every pound of salmon going into value-added frozen products also helps to balance the domestic and international supply and demand between tall canned salmon and other more valuable product forms. The Salmon Product Development Tax Credit has helped raise salmon prices to the fishermen, has increased the value of the raw fish taxes as the price of salmon has increased, and it has created additional processing jobs in Alaska that were previously going out of state and out of the country. It has also helped the economics of the seasonal but expensive onshore processing facilities. So changes in current statute that are proposed in House Bill 204 include the addition of herring, the addition of products from the current waste stream of salmon and herring, and a clarification regarding the small can sizes that are eligible for the credit. So utilizing more of the whole salmon and herring will create new products from what is now a waste stream and help processors meet ever-increasing EPA regulations. In your packet, you'll see that you have a two-page document on what the EPA is proposing for processing facilities to comply. It's a proposal, but there's efforts underway to force the seafood industry to eliminate the discharges containing solids into nearshore waters, and that's going to affect some of the smaller communities because they just don't have the economics in their region to deal with that. Finally, the addition of herring will create a new economic use for herring that is now underutilized when they're being caught for just the value of the herring eggs. A demonstration project funded by the state of Alaska as an appropriation to the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute has shown good potential for selling herring products and dried herring protein in underdeveloped nations. So you have letters of support in your packet. There's also information on the past expenditures and credits taken for the last 3 years. And there's a one-page sheet that's helpful for showing what sort of equipment is allowable under the Salmon Product Development Tax Credit. With that, Mr. Chair, I can do a sectional, but I can also just be available for questions.
Well, let's ask the committee if there's any questions at this point for Ashtree. No questions? Do you want to walk through the sectional, please, then?
Sure. To make it easy, I won't do it. I'll just be thorough. Because the bill now includes herring, the term herring is added in all sections of the bill, so you'll see that reflected throughout all of the sections. On section 3, page 3, qualified investment now also includes new parts necessary for or costs associated with converting a canned salmon line to produce can sizes other than the 14.75 ounces and 7.5 ounce cans. That was on line 21 and 22. Then on lines 25 through 27, you'll see that freezing, scaling, grinding, meat and bone separation are added to what already qualifies for the tax credit. And on section 5 on page 4, or sorry, section 5. Sorry about that. Page 4, section 7, lines 11 and 12. Equipment used to transform salmon or herring byproduct that is discarded as a waste and a saleable product is now a qualified investment. Would now be a qualified investment. So those are the major changes.
Thank you. Questions for members of the committee at this stage? This is the first hearing on the bill. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your list of disqualified equipment for the tax credit, what's a dud detector? I'm not familiar with that term.
Through the chair, I would love to defer that question to the Department of Revenue because I don't know the answer to that.
Senator Ellis, could you please repeat the question? I didn't catch it.
What's a dud detector?
Okay. And what page is that on?
Through the chair, I think that's the handout that's on what equipment would qualify or not qualify.
Okay.
Seems pretty important that there's a list of things that equipment that qualifies and a list of equipment that doesn't qualify. Mm-hmm. It may not have very much importance, but I'm curious.
Mm-hmm. So, very good question. So we have a number of folks that. Let's have Mr. Kazmak from DOR come up. Hopefully you're going to be able to answer our question. Please identify yourself for the record, who you're affiliated with, and if you could help us out with that.
Okay. For the record, my name is Michael Kazmak, and I am a tax auditor with the Department of Revenue. And through the chair, Senator Ellis, a dud detector is a device that detects when a vacuum seal is inadequate on a finished can of salmon.
Thank you. Thank you. We have other folks. We have Vince O'Shea with Pacific Seafoods Processors online there for any questions. We have Joe Plesha, Trident Seafood, Mark Palmer, President of Ocean Duty Seafoods. Let's go to Mr. O'Shea. Mr. O'Shea, can you please state your name for the record, who you're affiliated with, and if you have testimony?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay? I'm calling in.
Yes.
Well, I'm Vince O'Shea, and I'm Vice President of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and I live in Juneau. And I'm speaking on behalf of the PSPA members today who collectively operate about 18 salmon processing plants in Alaska from Ketchikan up to Bristol Bay. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of HB 204, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate you taking it up today as well. This bill allows the processing industry to take a credit against the fish taxes, the fisheries business tax that we're paying on the fish that we buy, and to offset purchases of new equipment that would add value to the products that we're making. In the past, this credit has gone to things such as fillet machines and as well as ice. And some of our members have also used it to purchase centrifuges to convert fish oil into a product that could be made into fish capsules. All of this is moving, expanding the product line away from cans and into items that are generate greater return in the market. I think that we also have a letter in the package for you, Mr. Chairman, that's with the bill that I sent in on the 24th of February that outlines our support. And I think the last point is renewing this bill for 5 years would both give the industry stability and would position us going forward to be able to take advantage of both new technology as it is developed and as well as new markets as they're developed in the next 5 years. So I think the track record for the industry using this bill and the results have been good, as outlined by Astrid Rose from Representative Osterman's office, and I would certainly hope that the committee would move this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Any questions for Mr. O'Shea from the committee at this point? Seeing none, Joe Plesha, are you online with Trident Seafood out of Seattle?
Yes, I am. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I am Joe Plesha. I work for Trident Seafoods. I'm the chief legal officer for Trident, and I'm pleased to support HB 204. And I wanted to give a little bit of background of why I think it's important that it be adopted for purposes of adding value to the product that currently is discharged. And to give a little bit of background to that, Alaska is the only state in the union that allows for seafood waste to be ground and discharged. The Environmental Protection Agency is reviewing its effluent limitation guidelines, and we believe that very soon they will be changed such that most of the communities in Alaska will have to screen their waste and then handle that screened waste in some manner. The most obvious is producing some sort of product with that waste. And so it's important, I think, for the economics of the industry that this bill be passed so that the industry can develop the technologies to utilize that waste and put it into a value-added product form. So those reasons, we support passage of the bill, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Plesha? Seeing none, Mr. Palmer, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Please identify yourself for the record and please who you're associated with and give your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mark Palmer. I'm the president of Ocean Beauty. I'm president and CEO of Ocean Beauty Seafoods. We're based, our corporate offices are here in Seattle, and we have 6 processing plants in Alaska. I'm here in support of House Bill 204 as well, and thank you for hearing it today, Chairman Dunleavy and the committee. You know, this piece of legislation has been around for a while, and it's worked. You know, from day one, the intention of this bill, when we were at the very low point of the salmon industry, was to spark investment, was to have processors invest in product diversification, which ultimately led to market diversification, and it's worked extremely well in that sense. We were over-dependent on 2 product forms, on canned salmon and H&G salmon, and by diversifying our markets and not being dependent on those 2 product forms, being able to move into fillets, portions, burgers, there's oils, the things that have been described earlier, we now have the ability to right-size a lot of these markets, and I will defend the canned market in the sense that it was a very poor market when that was your only alternative, but now we've been able to right-size those markets, we pack for the market, and we've seen an increase, it's over tripled in value since its low point in around 2005. So, you know, what we're trying to do by extending this tax credit is preserve the value that we've created for the fleet. We've created additional tax revenue through that. And it's also increased our ability to deal with very large runs. And to the credit of the managers of fisheries in Alaska, we've seen some of the largest pink salmon runs on history. Last year was our largest. So as these runs build, the investment we've put in to deal with fish in more product forms has also increased our ability to deal with larger runs, again, generating additional revenue for the state and our fleets and our companies by not having to turn away that fish. And so it's critical that this gets extended. It's worked extremely well, and we've seen the kind of investment it's stimulated, and I know it's going to do another wave now with taking fish waste and turning it into sellable products, hopefully adding some additional value to the herring, for the herring fishermen that are out there that are seeing the worst market ever this year for their herring products. So we encourage you to vote yes on this, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Palmer? Senator Machicki.
Hello, Ms. Palmer. I have a couple questions for you through the chair here. So I support the bill, and I'll tell you why I support the bill. Number one employer in the state, however, an awful lot of those jobs go to folks somewhere else. And I traveled this fall to a couple of plants that are selling Alaska fish in Europe. A lot of European hands being employed for final processing of those fish. So my question is this, what kind of assurance can you give us that this tax credit will be used to work as hard as we can to employ more Alaskans in the final finishing of Alaskan seafood?
Through the chair, Senator Chickie, you know, one of the things that we've done to try and have products further processed and ready for the European market, a great example is on sockeye salmon fillets. You know, listeria control is really important, and a lot of those companies over there felt like they could only import headed and gutted salmon because they wanted to handle the fish, provide a kill step, and make sure that the food safety aspect of their product was as protected as it could be for their brands and their markets. And we've invested in more, by having these additional value-added processes, we have more employees in our plants. We have more QC people. We have more technical people. And one of the things that's given us the ability to do is work with customers that want a cold smoked salmon in Europe, and we're providing them with a skinless, boneless, or skin-on boneless, listeria-free fillet. And had we not had those additional QA resources and those additional technical resources, so that would be one example of how we further processed in the state, created value, and still supplied an export market that was there. There's those same opportunities on once frozen chum. You know, as we've seen the Atlantic salmon markets, they're almost at an all-time high right now. There's a lot of customers around the world that are interested in more value-added products from chum. Traditionally, that fish has gone to China, just like you say, and is reprocessed over there and creates jobs there. But I think we're going to have opportunities to do one frozen product from chum this year for customers. We already have some agreements in place. And so it's those kinds of investments that create more and more opportunity. I can't foresee everyone down the road right now, but I can at least give you those two examples of jobs that we've created in Alaska. And there's the machinist positions, too. When you put this equipment, this is very sophisticated equipment, and you're creating machinist jobs up there. These are high-paying jobs. And so I think it is very good for Alaska.
Follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
That's very good. Thank you. And so a couple more questions. What is the herring market? Is it animal food, some sort of fish meal, or is there a human being, someone who loves pickled herring? Is there a demand for the remainder of the herring for a sort of gourmet human food?
Well, two things. The markets that we've investigated so far are human. We've filleted and canned herring fillets. So we've actually produced a container and a half or so of fillets last year, and we're going to try and produce 5 containers of herring fillets this year in a canned market. These are initially targeted really at food aid programs. The government spends a lot of money in food aid all around the world. Most of that's targeted at other proteins and at grain and whatnot, but we have had a test. The product was well received. And so we think that's, you know, a good stepping stone for starting a canned line of products that would have application where we could do flavors or other things from that. But the first market is that. The second is we are a large producer and seller of pickled herring, and we've talked to a couple of customers about a product that would have Alaska herring on the label. They're very intrigued by that. The fat content of the herring isn't as high as the Atlantic herring that they've been using, but if we can overcome that with some recipe adjustments, we do have some customers that are interested in trying to test market that.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Well, I will volunteer the chair and I here, Senator Dunleavy. I'm sure we can bring him along as being a pickled herring fan as well.
Miracles of happening.
You'll be the test group?
Well... One final question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
Does this limit your packaging options, Are you still limited on cans and can sizes and can types, or is this are you wide open on packaging options?
Well, I think we're wide open on packaging options. What, you know, the piece of the bill that this really addresses in can sizes, as we've seen the value of salmon increase, we have products that are on the shelf now, a tall can of sockeye that retail for over $10. And what this isn't targeted at is for us to continue to increase the price of salmon. I think we have to do two things. We have to utilize the waste, much the way you look at row credit with salmon. A lot of the value of that fish is in its row, and if we can start to create value in the waste stream, it's going to give us the ability to continue to pay higher prices as expenses go up, insurance, operations for fishermen. And if we can reduce the can size, that's just marketing. Consumers like to walk in, and they like to pick something up that fits in a price range. And our biggest customers, Bumblebee, Chicken of the Sea, John West, and others, have sat down and said, look, let us market, but give us the size of can that we can market. The consumer household size is reducing. We have too much fish in this can. We need to target this audience in a way that they'll respond. And so that's really what it's to take these can lines, which there's a ton of them across the state of Alaska, and help us modernize and target that consumer.
Thank you. Last one, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Michicki.
And then we didn't talk much. We kind of didn't talk about organic fertilizers, fish meals, and animal foods. I remembered when pinks were at a depressed price there back in the early 90s. Is there any? Are there any options for those other markets as well?
You know, I might, if Joe Bless is still on the line, I can tell you that Trident has made, you know, some significant investments in Cordova, and they've been probably opening up more markets. We have a new oil plant at our Excursion Inlet facility, and we've opened up a market. It's for supplements for pet food right now. We don't have the level of sophistication to refine the oil there for nutraceutical or pharmaceutical, but maybe I could defer to Joe, and he could comment on that.
Mr. Plush, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name one more time for the record, who you're associated with, and there was a question from Senator Michicki, and he'll restate it.
Of course. I'm Joe Plusher. I work for Trident Seafoods.
Yeah, Michicki. Joe, I just asked what the increased markets are looking like for organic fertilizers, fish meal, and animal food on the sort of lower quality fish products in Alaska.
Well, the market is expanding, and there are new product forms that are being developed, as Mark mentioned. We are encapsulating salmon oil for human consumption. If you go to Costco, for example, many of the salmon oil products that they have are actually produced in Alaska, mostly by us. And then we also produce hydrolysate, which is a liquid fertilizer from seafood processing waste that we market domestically in the United States, as well as traditional fish meal, which also has value mostly in Asia, but it's certainly a product that's increasing in value as people are looking for more protein sources.
Okay. And just maybe just to wrap it up, Mr. President.
Senator Michicki.
Mr. Chairman. Recent visit by Clem Tillion. I just have to pass this on because it's worth it. He talked about the prices of fish oil and the price of cans these days. He said the real market is they only put fish in the can to get you to buy the oil in the cans. So that's a little joke, but the reality of it is we have a huge diversity of products in this state that have largely gone to waste for many years. So I hope this bill will help develop some of those products.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee for the folks sitting in front of us or online? Seeing none, if we can have Anna Kim with DOR and Joe Jacobson with EEC come up, please. So if we could have you folks identify yourself for the record, who you're associated with. And I know that Mr. Jacobson has a short presentation And Ms. Kim is here on the DOR, Department of Revenue side of things.
Anna Kim, Department of Revenue Tax Division.
And Joe Jacobson, I'm the Director of the Division of Economic Development, the Department of Commerce.
Thank you. So before Mr. Jacobson begins, Ms. Kim, you're here for questions. Is that correct, or do you have a presentation as well?
No, I don't have a presentation. If anyone has questions, I'm here for that.
Are there any questions for members of the committee for Ms. Kim with the Department of Revenue on the tax side of things? Seeing none. Mr. Jacobson, you have a presentation. Is that correct?
I do.
And it's in our packet, I believe?
It is.
We're going to take a brief at ease. Mr. Jacobson is with the Department of Commerce. He's identified himself for the record. He has a brief presentation, so please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this a little bit more brief because there's been so much testimony already, which pretty much highlights a lot of what I'm going to talk to here, but I'm testifying in support of this bill on behalf of the department. One of the things I just wanted to remind everyone is that while Alaska is a huge seafood state, I mean, we produce 95% of all salmon in the U.S., but we only produce a third of the global wild salmon supply. And especially with the wild salmon resource, the only way to really increase value to our fishermen is by increasing the value of the product. We have had good fortune recently in terms of having strong runs, but, I mean, we are at the really the whims of nature to some extent, and we can't just turn on the spigot and get more production. So investing in value-added products is incredibly important for the state. And just for point of reference, my prior job was I was the international director with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, so I have quite a bit of experience working with seafood around the state. Some of the key benefits of the product development tax credit, I think first and foremost, it's really adding product diversity. By just as we don't want to be dependent on any one market, whether it's domestic or export, we don't want to be dependent on any one product form. And previously, when the industry was exclusively headed and gutted and canned salmon, I mean, you pretty much have a commodity that is much more susceptible to the whims of the market. So by increasing more value in the product and having different products for different markets around the world, it benefits the fishermen and the state in general, especially with the focus of underutilized species like the herring and the waste byproduct. This is a huge opportunity for the state, and as everyone mentioned, the impending EPA regulations will potentially have a huge impact on the state in that. So it allows us to take something that could be a real problem for the industry and turn it into a revenue generator and help ease that transition. And in terms of canned salmon, it incentivizes new production. As mentioned, I mean, if you go to a supermarket here in Juneau, a tall can of sockeye salmon is $11 or $12, depending on which supermarket you're in. And that's just beyond the realm of probably what's really acceptable in a lot of markets these days, especially overseas. I mean, as you see consumer demographic shift towards smaller households or an aging demographic for some of the canned salmon products, that's just a lot of product. So you can actually get a higher margin by putting in by selling it in a smaller can. And the nice thing about this bill is it doesn't dictate what the industry has to do, whether it's a pop top. That's really up to the producers. They just can't do what they have been doing, which is producing a 7.5 ounce or a 14.75 ounce can. So this graph here just basically illustrates what's happened with canned salmon prices since 2005. And really, you've seen a doubling of prices almost across the board. And, you know, with few exceptions, the tall and halves are the two predominant can sizes out there in the world. The addition of herring is potentially something that could be extremely impactful for a lot of communities. So you can see the number of active herring permit holders has dropped precipitously, especially gillnets. So this anything we can do to help stimulate the herring fisheries around the state, especially in parts of Western Alaska where there isn't much else, would be a welcome addition, whether that's through food aid or through innovation that could generate another consumer product, maybe expand our pickled herring production. We can help support a lot of communities that currently are suffering.
This is Senator Dunley, for the record. Is the issue with herring that the roe, in the 80s, selling roe to Japan was a big deal? How's that market changed?
Mr. Chair, the roll market in Japan has softened somewhat. It's a traditional product, but the younger generations aren't consuming it in the same manner, and in some respects aren't willing to pay the same prices that they used to. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable speaking too much about today's current market, so I'll speak in broad terms so I haven't stayed on top of it entirely. But a lot of production in Alaska is geared predominantly for roe, and the roe prices have dropped such that outside of Sitka and a few other places, as you get farther away from an established center, like if you're talking about Norton Sound, other areas, even Togiak, for some reason, you're not going to find the prices to support harvesting the fish for roe only.
Is that why the permit holders are dropping?
That is why the permit holders are dropping.
Good question.
Question, Senator Machicki.
What's the favorite gear type for food quality? Is that why you might be interested in getting gill netters back as opposed to seining, or does it matter?
Senator Machicki, I'm not sure that I know what the favored variety is. I think that I think maybe someone from UFA is here who could answer that specifically. I don't know the specifics of that. I think most of the seine fisheries are targeting herring for the roe content. I know there's a food and bait fishery, but I'm not really sure what the reasoning is for that. I think it's also just a vessel size issue and gear type. So, I mean, most of Western Alaska is, I believe, fishing gillnet farther north than Togiak, if I'm not mistaken, but I could be wrong.
Any additional questions from members of the committee at this point? Seeing none, go ahead and continue, please.
So in terms of the EPA, the biggest issue here is really is the relation of non-remote seafood processing centers. This is, Ketchikan, Juneau, Cordova, Naknek, anywhere on the Kenai Peninsula for the most part. And that would be they'd be required to go to a zero discharge on any of their waste products. So they'd have to screen and either use that product into a saleable good, or they'd have to collect the waste and then barge it to an offload site, basically. And so, I mean, really the costs are, very much dependent upon which area you're talking about, but it could be as much as 20 cents a pound or more in some cases. So I think that in the end, that's a cost that would come out of the fisherman's pocket. I mean, there is a market price, but if it's the cost of production, ultimately the fishermen are the one who are going to feel that probably most acutely. So that's in terms of the waste byproduct opportunities, Mark and Joe mentioned some of the investments in fish meal, fish oil, and other things like protein isolates, which is like a protein powder, which has been explored for the food aid side of things from the herring products, which is essentially a fish powder that could be added into a mix and rehydrated and add a high value protein to meals around the world, and also something that's shelf stable and easily transportable. And this is just showing what's happened with the total value of Alaska commercial salmon fishing permits. And this is not this won't solve all the problems, but it's along with key marketing and investing in quality and such, the diversification of products has really been a key element of increasing the value of the industry to the state. So this shows a steady incline of the permit values. And also in terms of just the participation in Alaska's fisheries, and this isn't just something that takes place in terms of processing jobs, that's something that could be impacted, but as the value has gone up, we see more and more Alaskans wanting to actually be fishermen and stay in the communities. So whether it's as permit holders or crew, the participation in Alaska fisheries has gone up significantly. And this is just the final slide, just to show, when we talk about this, how much does it really cost the state in relation to how much the revenue, or how much revenue from fisheries business tax has gone up? So, it hasn't gone up, incredibly. So, I think it demonstrates it's a good return. There's a good return on investment here. So, and with that, it's the end of my presentation.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Jacobson? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to open this up for public testimony. Do we have anyone online? Any folks in the audience that haven't signed up that feel a need to testify in the bill right now? We're going to leave public testimony open. Are there any additional questions for members of the committee before we move this bill off to the side? We're going to hear it at a future date. Seeing none, we'll take a quick at ease and move to the next bill. Okay, we're back on the record. We're now turning to HB 141. It's a bill sponsored by Representative Olson. This is the second hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill is Anna Latham, staff to Representative Olson. So if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anna Latham, staff to Representative Olson. And before you today is House Bill 141. This legislation sets the fee schedule for workers' comp claims treated outside of the state of Alaska and establishes billing timelines for medical providers. To provide a little bit of background about workers' comp fee schedules, the state has used a usual, customary, and reasonable fee schedule for workers' comp, reflective of the costs in the geographic area where services are rendered, and billed at the 90th percentile for the past 10 years. In 2011, the legislature passed House Bill 13, which extended the current fee schedule. But what House Bill 13 failed to do was set any parameters for where the fee schedule could be used. As you may be aware, Alaska has the highest workers' comp premium rates in the nation. The Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services conducts a biannual study ranking all 50 states in Washington, D.C., based on workers' compensation rates. The industry uses this as a benchmark for comparing workers' comp costs across the nation. For the past 10 years, Alaska has ranked in either the first or second place. This isn't an enviable position for any state to be in. And I'd like to provide some examples of the discrepancies between medical workers' comp costs in Alaska and other Western states.
Sure.
I'd like to draw your attention to the top 25 surgery procedure code fee comparison charts that's in your packet. And as you can see, the costs vary quite a bit between Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, but Alaska's costs are substantially higher. And I'd also like to bring your attention to the medical data report that was included in your packet. If you look at page 40, chart 30, there's a graph that's produced by the National Council on Compensation Insurance. They rank the top 10 diagnostic codes by total claim payments. And the first one is a diagnosis of a ruptured disc in the back. The average payment in Alaska for treating this condition is $31,177 compared to $17,049 countrywide. So that's a $14,128 difference, or 182% higher in Alaska. And I think that really frames the discussion and why this legislation was introduced. There's nothing in statute to prevent workers' comp claims treated outside from being billed at Alaska's higher rates. House Bill 141 would change that. Medical services treated in-state would still be charged using the UCR fee schedule that was established in 2011, and medical services treated outside couldn't exceed the charges set by the statute of the state where services were rendered. House Bill 141 also establishes some billing timelines. It requires a provider to submit bills for treatment within 180 days after the services are rendered and limits the time for appealing an employer's denial or reduction of a bill to 60 days. The effective date of this legislation is immediate, and there is a retroactivity clause, but there's also transitional language included. This language establishes that medical providers may submit bills for service within 180 days of the effective date of the legislation, irrespective of the date of service, or an appeal for denied payment within 60 days of the effective date of the legislation, irrespective of the date of the disputed payment. Currently, there isn't a provision that restricts the time frame in which a bill must be submitted for reimbursement or an appeal filed. So House Bill 141 sets reasonable time limits to provide certainty for the employer and the insurer as they budget and plan ahead for the future. So that concludes my testimony on 141, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Latham. And just for the record, I inadvertently said it was the second hearing in this bill. This is actually the first hearing that's being introduced today, so I want to correct that for the record. Do you have any questions from members of the committee?
I don't have any, thank you.
No questions at this point. We have, do we have in the audience Mike Monagle?
do you want to come up and add anything, or are you here just for questions? Do you have any questions for Mike, Mr. Monagle from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development? Nothing at this time. Do we have anyone online that would like to test? Excuse me. At this moment, we'll open up for public testimony. Is there anyone online? Seeing none. Is there anyone in the audience that feels compelled to testify on this bill today? For this bill? Huh, okay. Online, I think we have Mr. O'Shea again. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Can you identify yourself for the record, who you affiliate with, and begin your testimony?
Certainly. My name is Vince O'Shea. I'm the Vice President of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and I live in Juneau. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity for me to speak on behalf of the PSPA in our support of HB 141. I think the briefing that you had from Representative Olson's staff did a great job of outlining what the problem is here. From our perspective, from an industry perspective, we have over 27,000 workers that are working in seafood processing plants, and the fact that workmen's compensation rates are towards the top of the highest in the United States is something that really needs to be addressed. And the issue here isn't about not allowing or not treating workers or not helping them when they're injured. We certainly want to take care of that. But this is more of an issue of eliminating abuse and unnecessary expenses related to that treatment. So to speak both in favor of 141 as well as a broader agenda, Mr. Chairman, of overhauling other areas of Alaska's workmen's compensation rules is something that we're very interested in. We think it's good for business, and in the end, we also think it's good for the workers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. O'Shea from members of the committee? Seeing none at this point, online, I think we have Sally Stuvik from Fairbanks, North Star Borough. Are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Could you please identify yourself for the record and who you're affiliated with and begin your testimony?
Yes, my name is Sally Stuvik. I'm the Human Resources Director for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. I am the Director of Human Resources, and our Division of Risk Management handles the workers' comp self-funded programs for both the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. We spend approximately $1.1 billion a year on workers' comp benefits, and we have continued to see our medical costs increase in the workers' comp area. We believe that the resolution adopted by the Workers' Comp Board, 1301, dated September 27th of 2013, is a positive step to try to address those costs. And we are in support of this legislation as well as several other legislations that have come as a result of that resolution. The Borough Assembly did pass a resolution on February 13th of 2014, which it was provided to Representative Olson, so I'm hoping to give you a packet. And again, we're just here to support your efforts on continuing to pursue this legislation. So thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Any questions for members of the committee? Seeing none. Anyone else in the online or in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we're going to leave public testimony open. We will set the bill off to the side, and we will hear it at a future date. Next meeting will be Thursday. We'll bring up HB 32, HB 276, HB 234.
I just have one comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Michicki.
Hey, just on 141, it'd be interesting if one of these groups, because I think there's a couple of issues with the way of billing, and one of them is competition for our medical providers with medical tourism. I think it would cut back on that. But what I'd really like to see, like from the Joint Insurance Association, is what they think they might the There's a guy there named Kevin Smith. It'd be interesting to see if they did kind of a representative sampling of one community to see what they thought savings would be in a year, because I think it's really substantial. I hope we can get this bill through this year. And as Kevin says, it is a small step, but I think it's an important first one. So.
Thank you. We're adjourned.